This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. If you eat too much and you don't exercise, you're going to gain weight, right? Well, that's what we've been told. Nutritionists would say calories in must be less than calories burnt. But science reporter Gary Tobbs says that's an oversimplification, and it's really hormones and body self-regulation that controls our weight. Tobbs is one of 17 co-authors who contributed to a review published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that argues the reason so little progress has been made against obesity and type 2 diabetes is because the field has been laboring, quite literally, under the wrong paradigm. I spoke to Gary Tobbs about the report.
Well, what's new is the 16 co-authors, as you noted, among the most influential academic researchers in obesity and nutrition are signing on to a review article that's claiming that our fundamental understanding of obesity for almost the past century is incorrect. So we've always had this idea that obesity is an energy balance disorder. People take in more calories than they expend. And that's ultimately the reason for why they accumulate so much excess fat. And this article is saying that that's not correct, that that's actually a tautology, and we could explain that. And instead, obesity is a hormonal regulatory disorder. It's dominated by dysregulation of the hormone insulin, and that makes the sort of dietary cause of the disorder not how much people eat or how little they exercise, but the sort of quality and quantity of the carbohydrates in their diet. And yeah, I've been arguing this in my books for a dozen years now, and a handful of researchers have been arguing it, and I, you know, based my books on their work, but it's now moving into a mainstream discussion and being supported, as I said, by some very influential scientists.
But you were a nutrition heretic before.
Well, I'm still a nutrition heretic, but I've got a small minority, a growing minority of researchers are signing on and agreeing, and a growing minority of physicians are embracing the implications of this to treat their their patients with obesity and diabetes.
Let's talk about why this matters. We've had this old model of calories in and calories out, and we've had that forever. And yet we've been dealing with a worsening obesity and type 2 diabetes epidemic in the country. So we should at least recognize that what we have been doing isn't working, right?
Right. And that's, you know, the obesity research, the obesity research and therapy community will accept that, but they will implicitly blame it on their patients. The idea is because you get fat by eating too much, if you can't rein it in taking the advice of your physicians to eat less and exercise more, then clearly there's, you know, a failure of willpower on some level. That typically we won't ever use that kind of phrasing, but that's the implication. And yes, one of the important points here is we are, you know, there is very much an obesity and type 2 diabetes epidemic out there in America and worldwide. And it's serious. It's not going away. When the COVID issues pass, we'll still be left with levels of obesity and diabetes in this country that lead to direct medical costs of $1 billion a day to our medical system, not to mention the terrible burden of these disorders to the patients who suffer from them. And you know, again, one of the issues I've been making and some of the researchers who are signed on to this paper is that when you've completely failed to rein in an epidemic, that's been ongoing now for 50 or 60 years, at some point you have to question your understanding of the disease. And you have to step back and say, we can't simply continue doing business as usual. We have to ask, maybe the mistake is not with our patients being unwilling or unable to take our advice, but maybe with our understanding of the disease process itself. And this paper is in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, is a review of an alternative hypothesis of the cause of obesity. Again, that it's not about how much we eat and exercise, but about the effect of the foods we eat on the hormones primarily that regulate fat accumulation.
So it's as if we had people who were designing airplanes and those airplanes kept crashing and or not even getting off the ground. And we'd have to question whether or not these people actually understand aerodynamics or aviation engineering or even what an airplane is supposed to do.
Yeah, which is, of course, they're blaming the pilots, maybe the passengers, for being too heavy. And we're saying, yeah, maybe it's the airplane designers in that metaphor. And you can understand why the airplane designers might be hesitant to embrace this idea that they've had it wrong for, in this case, 90 years.
Well, because every once in a while, a plane does go up in the air. And every once in a while, it does land safely. And that's the one we focus on. I mean, I have managed to lose weight a couple of times in my life. And that was through a lot of hard work. And it was stressful, but I did manage to do it.
Well, that's one of the observations that's almost universally cited for this idea that we get fat because we eat too much, is that if you starve people or you can convince them to starve themselves, they will lose weight. So, and then, you know, people like me, it doesn't help that I'm a journalist. And I say, well, you can starve children and inhibit their growth, but you would never say that they grow because they eat too much. And you could starve tumors and inhibit their growth, but you would never say that people get cancer because they eat too much. So why is it this sort of fallacious logic works when we get to obesity? And, you know, it seems reasonable when you go, I am the only journalist or scientist who has ever gone back to document the history of this idea that we get heavy because we eat too much. And the history is fascinating, but a lot of it is just based on this idea that it's a sort of Falstaff view of history. You see these big, heavy men eating a lot, and you assume that the eating a lot causes the weight, instead of wondering if maybe the reason they're eating a lot is because they're so damn heavy and their bodies are predisposed to get fat. That's a different hypothesis.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're going to take a break. We'll continue chewing the fat about why we can't lose weight with science reporter Gary Tobbs. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. A perspective in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition challenges the energy balance model, which says weight gain occurs because individuals consume more energy than they expend. Science reporter Gary Tobbs argues for the carbohydrate insulin model, which explains obesity as a metabolic disorder driven by what we eat rather than how much. Let's get back to the conversation. So let's talk about hunger drive. What is the problem with hunger drive, and can that be managed?
Well, again, there are two ways to see it. The conventional thinking is that our brain is sort of constantly responding to these signaling molecules from the body. They have names like leptin and ghrelin, and it's making some assessment of how much fat you have available in your body, and it's trying to sort of regulate your fat mass. And for some reason in our food environment, this system breaks down, and again, people just eat too much and get too heavy. The other way to think of it, one of the points that I made in, well, let me backtrack a little bit. And what's happened in obesity research and in science in general is the 1930 to 1940, a key decade, obesity researchers decide obesity science is in effect a half dozen physicians around the world writing papers on occasions about what cause and what they think might cause obesity.
And
And
when you
there's
say
two.
science, are you putting quotation marks there?
I mean, it doesn't need them. This is indeed what obesity science is in the 1930s. You could put it in quotation because we tend to think of science the way we see it today, where there's thousands of researchers funded by a national agency and different countries and journals. And but again, if you look at this historically, up till 1930, there were two general ideas about how what causes obesity. So one of them is this idea that people just eat too much, and the other is this idea that it's constitutional. It's a great quote in a George Bernard Shaw play called Misalliance, where the one of the characters, John Tarleton, says it's constitutional. Some people just, put on fat if they're made that way, regardless of how much they eat. I just butchered that quote, by the way, but that's the gist of it. When you read the medical textbooks and their discussions on obesity, the writers are usually torn. They have some sense that some people eat a lot and get fat, and some people don't eat a lot or don't eat much at all and are still obese. And so there's some combination of these two. And in 1930, this University of Michigan researcher, Louis Newberg, comes along and he claims that he's proven experimentally that obesity is a eating disorder, eating too much. And Newberg's work sort of carries the day, in part because the theory that it's constitutional is being pushed by German and Austrian investigators who, in the 1930s, are doing the best medical science in the world. And then World War II comes along, the German and Austrian school vanishes, and we sort of inherit this belief of Newberg that obesity is an eating disorder. And as this happens, obesity researchers studying fat storage and fat metabolism itself are working out the science of what regulates fat storage in fat cells. And that's dominated by hormones. It can be independent of how much people are eating and exercising, because your fat cells are constantly taking up fat and mobilizing fat, and the fat is circulating around the body to be used for fuel. And that process is regulated by hormones, not by how much you're eating and exercising. So you get by the 1960s a science of fat metabolism that obesity researchers are ignoring because they've decided obesity is caused by eating too much. And the doctors treating obesity are ignoring because they've decided that their patients who are, burdened with this excess weight got that way because they ate too much. So the science of fat metabolism and fat storage is independent of the science of obesity, which is a problem of excess fat storage. And also simultaneously, there is a whole school of researchers in a field called physiological psychology who are studying the sort of physiological determinants of fundamental behaviors like eating behavior and drinking behavior. And the idea is that your eating behavior is a readout, in effect, of the availability of fuels in your body to your cells. And that fuel availability is also being regulated by hormones. So you've got a theory of fat accumulation that is regulated by hormones, primarily insulin and another hormone called glucagon, and a theory of hunger that it's going to be determined by how much fuel your cells make available and how much they lock away in storage. So again, regulated by hormones. And both those theories are ignored by the obesity people because they've decided obesity is just caused by eating too much. And they're trying to explain why people eat too much without ever paying, without ever noticing the research in these other fields. So the idea is, in effect, one theory says when, you get fat because these signaling molecules somehow aren't doing their job and your brain isn't responding sufficiently to this message that you're getting fatter. And the other theory says your brain is responding to the fuel that's being made available, particularly to cells in your liver, which is kind of a central processing point for all the nutrients in your body. And if you're preferentially storing calories as fat and you're not making them accessible to be used for fuel, then you're going to be hungrier than you would be otherwise. And that's precisely what happens in obesity.
Hormones, we keep talking about hormones and as a driver of whether or not we're going to eat a lot and how our body processes those calories. Doesn't our microbiome, all those little critters in my stomach, they create hormones as well?
They do, but our understanding of the microbiome is at a very primitive level. Yeah, I get skeptical. My training is a journalist. I've been writing about controversial science for over 40 years now, which is a little frightening, just about 40 years. And I started off writing about physicists and nuclear physicists who discovered non-existent phenomena. So I'm very aware of how easy it is to screw up in science. And when I was young, the physicists I used to interview had a sense of science. The front lines of science is like little kids playing soccer. Yeah, one of them kicks the ball and they all run after the ball. And then another one kicks the ball in another direction. They all run off in another direction. And if you were just watching where the ball was going and where the kids were running, you might actually have no idea where the goals are. And the gut biome is where the ball has been kicked in the past 10 years. And there's a lot of interest in it because we finally have tools to study the bacterial species that inhabit your gut. And that's new. And because it's new, a lot of research has been pursuing it and a lot of people have been making claims about it. It's easy to get funded if you're studying the gut biome. It's easy to get written up in the papers and get your articles published in the medical journals. But it's, my take, which is that of a skeptic, is that it's just where the ball has been kicked and it's going to might be another 10 or 20 years before we find out where the goals are.
So looking at then insulin as a driver of obesity and insulin insensitivity with also causing diabetes as well. So is that what we should be focused on? Is that the goal?
Well, that's what this article is arguing, and that's what my work has argued. So we've known, in effect, since the discovery of insulin in 1921, that insulin is the hormone that dominates fat accumulation. The individual with type 1 diabetes don't produce enough insulin, and prior to insulin therapy, they were, in effect, incapable of storing calories as fat in their body. They would die emaciated before insulin therapy. And in the right around 1960, with the discovery of the creation of a assay technology to measure insulin in the bloodstream, researchers realized that patients with type 2 diabetes, which strongly associates with obesity, have too much insulin in their bloodstream. They're insulin resistant, and so their pancreas pumps out too much insulin. And by the mid-1960s, it was clear that insulin was the hormone that dominates fat accumulation. So what that means, every hormone will have some effect on fuel availability in your circulation and how much and whether or not you're storing fat or mobilizing fat into your bloodstream, because hormones are telling your body to do something. And they, in effect, tell your cells to make the fuel available for that action to be done as well. So every hormone, for the most part, works to mobilize fat from your fat cells to make that fat available to your cells for fuel, so that whatever they're telling your cells to do will have the fuel available. Insulin is the one hormone that works to put fat in your fat cells, and it dominates this process. When insulin levels are elevated, you're storing calories as fat. And it's interesting reading the history. Researchers knew this, and they knew that insulin was responding primarily to the carbohydrates in your diet. Basically, it's the cells in your pancreas that secrete insulin are responding to elevated, to rising tides of blood sugar, and blood sugar is glucose. It's a carbohydrate. So they knew that carbohydrates raised insulin, that insulin caused fat to accumulate in fat cells. But again, they never made this meaningful connection to what might be happening in obesity, because they had convinced themselves that we get fat because we eat too much.
Some people say the one reason why we eat too much is because we live in a time of hyper delicious food. The brain reward is too good.
That's the conventional thinking. The food's just too good. It's too available. It's too easy. And therefore, we just can't say no. But one of the problems with that is that some people don't get obese. It's an ever smaller proportion of the human race as we go forward. But some people stay enviably lean in this food environment in which we live. So the question then becomes, how do they do it? And what's the difference between the people who stay lean and the people who don't? The people who, you know, fatten easily, to use the sort of 1950s diet book lingo. It'd be nice if we had a theory of obesity that didn't ultimately blame it on the brain and willpower. And the energy balance idea, one way or the other, you end up getting back to the idea that some people just can't control their behavior, which is how much they eat and exercise.
They're also learning a lot about metabolism now, whatever I guess is your resting rate for burning calories.
Basal metabolism.
Now we're seeing that it doesn't drop off like they had said it did as you get into your 60s.
Well, this was one of the assumptions. You have to explain why people tend to get heavier as they get older. And so if you believe that people get fat because they eat too much and exercise and expend too little. So this idea that it's this energy imbalance. The assumption was, we all heard this, as we get older, our metabolism slows down. So that might explain why we don't eat any more than we ever did, but then we get fatter nonetheless. These measurements were never really made, and they're very hard to do, to measure metabolism properly. Energy expenditure properly requires locking people away for 24 hours or more in a small room called a metabolic chamber. And once you lock them away, you change their metabolic rate by doing so. Or you could use a technique called doubly labeled water, where you inject them with a kind of radioactively labeled isotope of hydrogen, and you can measure their excretion rates, and that'll tell you something. But they all have errors, and the errors are bigger than what you're the effect you're trying to measure. So now there's a new study out there, an assessment of all these doubly labeled water studies that have been done for decades, suggesting that, hey, lo and behold, as people get older, their energy expenditure really doesn't change. So now you have to explain why they get heavier. And now you're left with, well, they're just eating too much. We should, by the way, in the process of this, quantify what this energy balance idea means to people. Can I take a minute to do that? Because this is one of, in my books, in this article I wrote for Stat, is one of the sort of stunning concepts. If you just assume that you're one of these people who between, say, age 25 and 45, you gain 40 pounds. So you go from being lean in your post-college years to being obese by your mid-40s. 40 pounds in 20 years is the equivalent of 2 pounds of weight gain a year. And then you ask what that means in terms of fat storage. And what it means is that every day you were storing 20 calories of fat that you weren't burning for fuel. So the idea is 20 calories are stored in your fat tissue every day, and that builds up over 20 years to 40 pounds of fat, to the difference between being lean and obese. And what that means is over the course of a day, the average American will eat around 2,500, 2,700 calories of food. And most of the fat they'll consume and some of the carbohydrates at some point during the day will be stored as fat. So they might store, say, 1,200 calories in their fat cell over the course of a day. And if only 1,190 of it come out, and the remaining 20 stay behind in your fat cells, you will grow obese over the course of 20 years. And so what we're asking is, why do people store 20 calories a day as fat? And what is the idea that there's this food environment and all the food is so palatable and they just can't say no? Why does that stop them from storing 20 calories a day as fat? Why can't they just eat a little less? Yeah, that's like two almonds worth of fat, a couple of gummy bears. So again, since the 1920s, people who have thought about this have been saying, when you look at that number, how small it is, the daily accumulation of fat, how can we blame it on energy balance? And how did anyone stay lean when all you have to do is overshoot by 20 or 50 calories? You have no idea how much you're expending day to day. How does anyone stay lean in this environment? The answer is, when you start thinking of it like that, the energy balance notion, this idea that we get fat merely because we take in more energy than we expend, starts to break down, starts to sort of fail on a fundamental level.
So looking at actionable information based upon this study, this report, what would be the best way? What do you recommend for people to do?
Well, the actionable information, and again, this is an academic review article, so it doesn't, you won't find a sentence like this in it. But the conventional wisdom is, for diet to work, it's got to create a negative energy balance. People have to eat less than they expend. This carbohydrate insulin model says that for a diet to work, ultimately, it's got to lower insulin levels. And the way you lower insulin levels is you avoid the easily digestible carbohydrates in the diet, sugars, starches, grains, and replace them with either low glycemic index carbohydrates, which are fiber-rich carbs, or green leafy vegetables, or sources of protein and fat, which tend to be animal products, which is one of the reasons why this carbohydrate insulin model is not liked by certain nutrition camps, because it implies that for many people who suffer from overweight and obesity, they need to eat fat-rich foods and without carbs in them, and those are regrettably tend to be animal products.
You think popular culture is ready to give up on this old model of calories in, calories out? You know, the Biggest Loser stuff.
I think we're going two ways on this. I think the research establishment you're an academic researcher, you've built up a career believing your fundamental belief system is obesity is an energy balance disorder. Everyone you know believes the same thing. You've become a full professor, you get funding, you get awards and positions on panels and committees, because all based on the idea that we all believe this one concept, that it's an energy balance disorder. It's very hard to give all that up. It is, in that sense, very much like a religious belief. And if you give it up, you have to leave your church and join the heretics. And that's not easy for anyone to do. And it's not easy to admit that you've spent your whole life simply wrong about the fundamental cause of the disease you study. So on one level, I don't see energy balance imbalance going anywhere, because too many people have sort of committed their lives to believing it and to disseminating it. On the other level, this idea that carbohydrates are inherently fattening, which is what the carbohydrate insulin model comes down to. For those of us who put on weight easily, it's the carbohydrates in our diet that trigger it. that weight gain goes through the carbs and the diet, not through how much we're eating. I think that's catching on. You see it all the time now in the, you know, television shows and movies and, you know, the popular culture, the idea that carbohydrates are fattening and that sugar in particular is a problem. So it's a sort of expanding divide between the academic research community and then the people who really just want to keep their weight under control to achieve and maintain a healthy weight. The popularity of keto, the ketogenic diet, is again indicative that there are, you know, millions of people out there who have concluded that the best way to lose weight and maintain a healthy weight for them is a diet that the mainstream medical community until very recently has thought of as very dangerous. They've come around on that too, but it's taken, you know, 60 years of pushing.
Gary Tobbs is the author of The Case Against Sugar and Why We Get Fat. He's the co-author of a report that explains that the traditional energy balance model for weight gain is wrong. He says the carbohydrate insulin model explains obesity as a metabolic disorder. When we come back from the break, we're going to get the latest on the childhood obesity crisis. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A new report by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation finds that roughly 1 in 6 youth in the U.S. have obesity. Texas is ranked 8 in the nation for the highest obesity rate, which is about 20%. Childhood obesity is linked to a number of health conditions, including type 2 diabetes, hypertension, and a number of cancers. So what can be done about this growing problem? We're joined by Jamie Bussell, a senior program director at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. You can call in with the question, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can send us an email to thesource@tpr.org or text us at that number, 833-877-8255. And Jamie Bussell, welcome to The Source. So tell us more about the data. What does it show us?
Sure. So the data that we actually released last week shows the national picture that 1 in 6 young people between the ages of 10 and 17 in the U.S. has obesity. And as you had alluded to, it puts them at greater risk for things like heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and some types of cancer. So again, it's about 16.2% is the national average, and that's compared to, as you articulated, about 20% in the state of Texas.
Many people were anxiously waiting for this report to see what COVID conditions have done in this area. And what do you see?
Sure. So not surprisingly, COVID has certainly exacerbated the childhood obesity epidemic. And in fact, we see both of these conditions in many ways exacerbating one another. And I say that that should not surprise us when you look at some of the systemic factors like inadequate access to healthy food, stagnant incomes, lack of access to health care. These are all issues or determinants that really contribute to childhood obesity. And so again, not a surprise that we see, you know, the disproportionate impact of COVID on families living furthest from economic opportunity, kids of color, and the same, you know, same very much holds true when we look at the childhood obesity epidemic.
When we were first starting to discover, you know, what COVID was doing and the action that we needed to take, which is people were arguing we needed to go to home learning, and people were responding saying, yeah, but that's where a lot of kids go to eat. And they were reluctant to close down campuses because of that factor. What have we seen in regards to obesity with that?
Yeah, that is certainly, you know, had impact on kids who, as you said, depend on school meals. I'll say, you know, rising food insecurity has been, you know, driven by things like that, also driven by loss of employment. You have loss of stable housing. You have loss of school meals. And this, you know, these are matters that have been faced by millions of kids and families in this country. And again, really disproportionately impacting the health and economic livelihoods of communities of color. So I think it's important to, you know, lift up COVID and structural racism and, you know, really magnifying some of the longstanding racial and health inequities in our nation that we, again, see being played out, you know, by COVID as well as the childhood obesity epidemic. So, you know, these two issues, the relationship there, and again, the disproportionate impact of both of these on Black and Brown populations is a consequence of some of the, you know, longstanding structural racism in this country, and really a direct result of policies that have limited access to care and created social circumstances that increase risk of disease. So I think the big message here is that the fact that we've seen increases now in childhood obesity rates should not come as a huge surprise to any of us.
We just spent the first half of the program doing sort of a scientific-based discussion about why there is obesity, a problem with that in the United States, and why people have a hard time losing weight. And it's been argued that nutritionists kind of got this wrong. It's not calories in, calories out. It's what the calorie is, what you are eating makes a big difference. Is that something that needs to be applied, has been applied, or there is we're easing into when we talk about trying to find a path out of this childhood obesity crisis?
So I'll say a few things on that. And I was able to listen in for a little bit of the previous speaker. And again, I'm certainly not going to refute anything that he was saying. I'll say this. I think with childhood obesity, we have really, you know, built a strong field downstream. And we need to really be moving the discourse and moving the field upstream. And what I mean by that is really recognizing that, first of all, that the choices that people and families make are very much based on the choices families and kids have.
So the thing is, there's a concern about cheap calories that are filling, but those may be the wrong things, and that leads to childhood obesity.
Yeah, I think it's important to, you know, think about COVID laying bare some of the stark health and social inequities in our country and really underscoring the urgent need to be building equitable communities. And COVID presents, I think, an unprecedented opportunity for us to really rethink policies and redesign programs that prevent disease and better promote health for all. So, of course, at an individual level, you know, it does matter, you know, what we're putting into our bodies, but we're not able to put good, healthy, affordable food into our bodies if we can't access that good, healthy, nutritious, affordable food. So I think for us, it's really moving the conversation in a way that recognizes that this is not just, you know, an issue of healthy eating or physical activity, but this really is, you know, an issue around, does that child have a safe place to call home? Does mom or dad benefit from the kinds of supportive policies that we know enable kids and families to thrive? Does that child have access to high quality, affordable early care and education opportunities, health insurance, health care? So all of those determinants, if you will, really matter in terms of shaping the trajectory of a child's weight.
So one interesting thing about this new thought process and coming to, like, why is it so hard for us to lose weight and is our thinking wrong about obesity is it does take off the shame element of it. It's not, you know, willpower. It's not laziness. It's not slothfulness. It's our nutrition model is the concern. And is that helpful, especially when we talk about childhood obesity?
I think, again, you know, I'll just sort of emphasize, I think that we have a field that's really focused downstream, and we really need to start moving the conversation and the field in a way that moves us upstream to recognize, you know, things like the fact that millions of families in this country struggle with food insecurity, that we have a nation whose safety net is fragile and outdated and out of reach for millions of kids and their caregivers, that affordable housing is really scarce, and that there's structural racism embedded across all of these policies and systems and practices. And so all of that deeply impacts in really profound ways, you know, whether or not that child is going to be able to, you know, be healthy and maintain a healthy weight.
Right. We're going to take a break right now. We'll come back. We'll talk more about the issues of structural racism and how low income is a factor in these issues. And also there's a lot of cheap shot thinking that goes on in some areas, saying how can there be a hunger problem in America when we have an obesity problem in America. We'll tackle that as well. Our phone line is open. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about childhood obesity. A new report from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation shows that COVID has not been kind to the obesity rate that we have in the United States here in Texas. And we also have concerning numbers here in San Antonio. We're joined by Jamie Wussell. She's a senior program officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, giving us more information on that. And Jamie, you show us that the structural racism and people who live in low income communities and families, they're at high risk for this. Can you tell us more?
Sure. So, you know, I'll maybe say that the truth is that the relationship between COVID and obesity and the disproportionate impact of both of these diseases among particularly Black and Brown populations is a consequence of longstanding structural racism. And that means that the health disparities that we see are not by chance, but by design, and really a direct result of some very specific intentional policies that limit access to care, create social circumstances that really increase risk of disease. And so it's really important that we, you know, understand, take stock of that history and our current context, and help to kind of think about how do we unpack some of those root causes of these disparate effects that we're seeing, you know, both in terms of COVID and also obesity, so that we can be, you know, promulgating, advocating for, creating, moving meaningful policy responses that will make a difference in the lives of kids and families in this country.
So there are people who have said things like, how can we have a hunger problem in America if we have an obesity problem in America, particularly in these communities?
So, you know, I think the hunger, obesity, connection, if you will, it is sort of one of those great paradoxes where, you know, again, folks do not have, you know, adequate resources to enable them to purchase healthful, high quality foods. And so, you know, have been forced to depend on and rely on ultra processed foods that we know are more heavily dense in terms of, you know, calories. And so we see all that playing out. And I think that the important, you know, piece here, again, is to acknowledge that, you know, for kids of color, and again, those kids that are living furthest from economic opportunity are at greatest risk for obesity and for issues like hunger. And so, you know, the COVID pandemic is certainly, you know, exacerbating these issues when you already have obesity rates that are far too high, and there are things that we can be doing to address this. And I think, again, COVID, you know, presents us with, you know, I think an unprecedented opportunity here. Look, hunger in America, obesity in America, these are not new issues. These are issues that the nation has been grappling with for a really long time. I think the new piece here is this sense of urgency that we're all feeling to make change. And I think, you know, in the midst of this public health crisis that we're in the middle of, both, you know, the COVID crisis and, of course, the childhood obesity epidemic, it's more critical than ever that we really prioritize children's health and be committed to building a stronger foundation for the next generation.
School meals, these are now, they're back in school. They're able to access breakfast and lunch now. What's the quality of that food?
Yeah, so, you know, we know, I think the science really, you know, bears this out really solidly that school meals are really important source of nutrition for kids, you know, across the country. And as you said, you know, we now have in place universal school meals through the entire school year. So from 2021 through, you know, the conclusion of the school year 2022, that's a really important flexibility that has been deployed. But, you know, we need to be looking at making things like that permanent and providing resources to ensure every child has access to, you know, a consistent source of healthy meals. And we also, to your point, you know, I'm not going to say that, you know, every single school, you know, is doing 100% in terms of the most appealing, appetizing school meals. There's obviously been challenges, and COVID has exacerbated them around supply chain challenges. But I think it, you know, it really pushes us to ensure that, like, the highest quality nutrition standards are, you know, secured in the school meal program. So there's, you know, a lot that needs to be done, but we know that school meals are really important sources of nutrition for kids. It prepares them. They do better academically. I mean, there's a host of strong science around the importance of school meals and the opportunity we have to be pushing forward around making universal school meals a permanent provision.
You sound optimistic that this is a problem that can be dealt with. So help me see that.
Yeah, so, you know, I am. I'm actually, I remain optimistic and hopeful. And, you know, in the midst of, you know, a year and a half that has been filled with huge challenges, I'm also struck by progress we've seen, despite, like, the relentless challenges that we as a nation and world have faced. And I'll talk a little bit about those. But I think it's also important to lift up that, you know, the federal government has been able to deploy huge flexibilities across all of our food and nutrition programs in this country. But many of these are temporary emergency relief measures. And so what that means is it's sort of like putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. And so we need to be really thinking bigger and bolder about lasting solutions.
So all right, we're out of time. Thank you so much, Jamie Bussell, Senior Program Officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Thank you for coming on the air, helping us understand the problem of childhood obesity and how there is hope, there is optimism in figuring out a way out of that. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Jackie Velez and Xiaowen Chan. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.